On November 8, 2003, I interviewed Ted Nace, author of the book Gangs of America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. His book is an engaging account of the little-known history of the rise of corporate power in America. I'm Jerry Krantman, and you're listening to American Dream Radio. We're on the web at americandreamradio.org. We're here with Ted Nace, the author of the book Gangs of America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. Welcome to American Dream Radio, Ted.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jerry. One of the things that I feel is sort of that opens up minds is just challenging some of the conventional wisdom about American history itself. Just some of the real simple stuff that, just the idea of free enterprise democracy, that it's connected somehow to the American Revolution. You know, because actually there was two revolutions. There was a revolution 200 years ago that created the American system of government. And then there was a revolution about 100 years ago that set up the corporate system, and where the whole structure of how corporations are controlled changed very quickly. You know, as a result of the Santa Clara decision that Tom Hartman talks about, and then some other things that happened in that same period. Well, that's just not the way they teach American history. You know, that's not what Miss Kibler told us in fifth grade. And you know, just the stories about the Boston Tea Party, what it was really about, it's real interesting. You know, the fact that that was a fight between colonial merchants and this big British corporation, and that the merchants actually attacked the corporate ships. The corporation had an army, that the corporation had jails. You know, that the people were being brought to the New World to work on these corporate plantations. People just don't know that. People were being rounded up on the streets of England and brought over in chains and to work on these corporate tobacco plantations in the 1600s. I think there's a danger and a concern that I have in talking about the growth of corporate power over time, because it looks like this inexorable course. You know, like things are just getting worse and worse, and we really don't have a chance. So I also like to tell stories about how things went the other way. For example, there was a legal doctrine that existed in America long after the Bill of Rights. For 50, 60, even 70 years after the Bill of Rights, there was a doctrine still in place called the law of master and servant. And basically, this was the legal framework that had come out of feudalism in late medieval Europe. The law of master and servant said that in terms of how the law applies to the workplace is defined as a private domain, just like the family at that time. So, you know, for a long time, husbands could beat their wives and the law would not step in. You know, really, parents could do whatever they wanted in terms of their children. You can't say as a child, oh, I have the First Amendment. I get to say whatever I want. The parent says, no, you don't. I have authority over you, and the law will back them up. Well, this was also the way the law was construed to apply inside businesses. So until the 1840s, employers could beat their employees, and the courts didn't stop acting against that. You couldn't win a lawsuit on that basis until the 1840s. So just the idea that the Bill of Rights might apply, that the workplace wasn't governed by this feudal system, that it was something else entirely. You know, and all the sort of the premises of social Darwinism, the idea that any contract between an employee and an employer you know, had to be respected, that you couldn't have laws, say, affecting setting up minimum wages, because that interfered with the right of people to freely contract. This kind of libertarian notion. But what's missing from that is the real laws that existed at that time. There were these laws called crimes of status, that if you didn't have a job, or were either had a job or were looking for a job, you had no discernible means of support, you could be thrown in prison, or in England you could actually be branded with a V as a vagrant. In America, you could be thrown in prison. They had blacklists. People who lost their jobs in one company couldn't be hired by any others. So they had really a system. So not only did they control people within the workplace, but they were able to reach out beyond the workplace and control ex-employees they had systems where you would only be paid seasonally. You had to get to the end of the season to get your pay. They didn't define a day as 8 hours. They just defined a day as until they were ready to let you go. Well, so this very sort of almost feudal system that applied in the workplace didn't exist anymore by the 20th century because of the union movement. And when the union movement first arose, in many places, unions were absolutely illegal. You were breaking the law just to belong to a union or to be an officer of a union. So the fact that all these laws have been changed didn't just sort of happen. It happened because of struggle, and it was a victory. And I love that bumper sticker, you know, from the folks who brought you the weekend. it's important for people to know that it's not just a process where we've lost power and lost rights. That nothing is worth trying to gain. We're living in cynical times, but the history of the United States doesn't really argue for being cynical. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I love about Howard Zinn too. You know, not just the fact that they sold a million copies of The People's History of the United States, which is a completely different way of looking at American history, but it's entertaining. But the fact that the story is largely positive. Slavery didn't just go away, mm-hmm. and it didn't just go away because Abraham Lincoln, you know, signed something with his pen. Right. You know, it went away because of a movement that was successful. And there's so many movements like that that have been successful.
Hope in that
people won't get out of their chair unless they have hope. Yeah. They have to see success before they'll commit themselves. People are smart. They don't want to waste their time.
Do you think there's hope in this country, for corporations
back? This country is all about hope, and I think anybody who looked at the history of the last 25 years, when really it's been a right-wing resurgence, isn't really looking at American history. If they had assumed that that's the story of American history, past, present, and future, they're just looking at a little piece of it and extrapolating. Look at the New Deal. The New Deal came out of one of the most conservative periods of American history, the 1920s. There was the biggest skewing of income and wealth in the United States, even more than now, although now we're getting back to that level. 1% of the population owned more than 50% of the wealth in the late 1920s. The system sort of self-destructed to some extent, but in the midst of that sort of capitalist crisis, there was a whole new democratic resurgence, and so capitalism reemerged in a more democratic, socially friendly, social democratic way. We ended up with a whole lot of things that we people think of as European, Social Security. A lot of those things came here first, and then the Europeans copied them and did them even better than we did, universal health care. If you can't look at the career of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal and what came out of the Depression and not feel optimistic about America. In the 1920s, the courts were making it illegal for unions to organize in whole regions of the coal mining states. They had these blanket injunctions. It's amazing what the odds that people were able to beat in different times in American history. I think you can see evidence all over the place. A lot of people who sort of sat on their hands, say in the 1990s politically, are now interested in being more active. I mean, Americans generally, polls show Americans want environmental protection. They want universal health care. Polls show that. The majority of people want a woman's right to choose. Of course, people want good schools. All the things that people say they want are the sort of things that the ruling elite now opposes. Well, it's like Lincoln said, fool all the people some of the time, and you can feel fool some of the people all the time, but you cannot act in the interests all the time of what most people want. I just keep coming back to the American people are a lot more progressive than the government they're getting right now.
I, one of the things I really appreciated in your book was right in the beginning where you talk about how it seems somehow unpatriotic to be talking about corporations.
Well, that's why, you know, that's why I feel I feel privileged to talk about corporations because I come from a business background. And because I sort of lived the American dream, you know, I started a company on the kitchen table with $700 that I borrowed from my ex-girlfriend. And then we built up a multi-million dollar company. And, you know, you've got to respect the capitalist system for what it is. It's a machine that really works. But that doesn't mean that business interests should run the country. Political rights are not necessary for business to operate. They don't have to be able to contribute money to campaigns. I mean, in England, in Holland, in Germany, corporations are not allowed to give money to campaigns. Those are capitalist systems, and they don't collapse because businesses have been shut out of power. In fact, what I'm saying is that politics has to be a human space in order to work effectively. You bring in these multi-billion dollar economic machines, and you also equip them to be political machines. Ordinary people really can't compete with that kind of organized power. And that's what campaign finance reform is really all about. Now, when the courts come in and they say that those giant economic machines have political rights that are actually the rights of individual human beings against large institutions, then everything is screwed up. You know, then we have to try to get those court doctrines exposed for what they are. We have to shine the light of day on them and put the kind of pressure on them that causes those kind of things to change.
What would it take for issues like corporate personhood to even begin to be rolled back?
Well, like, I mean,
to actually start rolling something like that back, it's been in place for 130 years, 120 years.
You know, that's not, it's not necessary for people to all become experts in Supreme Court history. The point is, you know, and this happened in the 30s, a whole doctrine called substantive due process was completely abandoned by the court, not because Americans all learned the word substantive due process and wrote letters to the Supreme Court. It was because it's an example of, you know, what Everett Dirksen said, when I feel the heat, I see the light. The country was hurting so bad, and there was so much spontaneous political action going on. There were so many wildcat strikes that the unions couldn't even control it. And there were serious concerns among the elite, that includes Supreme Court justices, that the system was starting to kind of crack. They had to move it. They had to make it more user-friendly. In order for the New Deal legislation to be able to stick, so that it wasn't overturned by the courts, they had to throw out this doctrine called substantive due process. Well, substantive due process was based on the 14th Amendment and the Santa Clara decision and all that. It was based on corporate personhood, because it depended on interpretations of due process that were extremely broad. Well, the elites in the country heard the message coming up from the grassroots, and the grassroots didn't tell them specifically how they needed things to be changed, but they made it clear they wanted that New Deal legislation. The country wanted those programs that Roosevelt was pushing for. So later, you know, one of the things that happened was that you know, one justice basically flipped over to the pro-Roosevelt side, and he wrote in his memoirs exactly why he did it. He was really concerned that they needed to respond to this social pressure that was rising up. He talked about that, Judge Roberts. It's one of the best examples I can think of how change really happens. I think often people have too narrow a model of what has to happen, and so they'll go out and they'll. I was at a book talk in Berkeley, and this poor fellow raised his hand and he said, you know, I've been trying to explain to people at work about corporate personhood, and they just don't really get it. And I said, you know, stop talking to them about corporate personhood. Talk to them about something real. Just talk to them about corporate power. Or better yet, talk to them about who gets to read your email at work, or whether your medical records can be private. Those are the issues that people care about. They don't care about the particular judicial doctrine that, you know, allows your employer to, you know, to snoop into your personal life. So I think politicians have to also understand that. You've got to talk about what's real to people. You know, the rest will work itself out when people will realize there's an obstacle. I mean, this do not call list if the courts end up blocking it, it's going to be a great organizing issue. It's going to be a great organizing issue. Oh. They sued Al Franken for writing. Fox sued Al Franken for writing his book, Lying Lies and the Liars Who Tell Them.
Uh-huh.
That gave him more traction than anything else that could have happened. So really the best thing that could happen in terms of corporate rights is for the public to lose this right to, you know, turn off their phones.
Interesting.
It's an example of overreaching. Yeah. Power goes too far. Yeah. You know, it gets into people's lives and people don't like
that. Well, I'd love to see that become the issue that helps us turn some things around.
You know,
because that can be argued on a corporate personhood level as well. I mean, that's what they're doing.
Sure.
They're saying we have the right to call anybody anytime because it's free speech.
And they may convince a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They may convince people that, oh, you have to put up with this.
Well, what happens if we successfully turn this around with the trade agreements we have, with globalization? Seems like corporations can take their ball and go play in a different field, except for cashiers and truck drivers and hairdressers who they have to hire here. But almost anything else could be made overseas. Even the Republican Party now is doing their fundraising. Their telephone calls for fundraising are being done in industry.
I call that exit power, the exit right.
Yeah.
This isn't something that's preordained. Corporations don't naturally have the power to move overseas. They didn't have that power until around 1903. Until 1903, a majority of states, well, let me put it this way, until the 1880s, most states didn't have general incorporation. They had a different type of corporate law. And one of the facets of that older system of corporate law was the physical location and the legal location of a corporation had to be one and the same. And there were other sorts of measures that kept corporations from simply arbitrarily moving. This changed when New Jersey changed its law, and then the other states all had to follow this sort of.
That was fascinating. I read about that in your book. I was amazed by that.
People assume, oh, corporations will always be able to just move overseas. Not if the law doesn't let them. And there's ways of changing that. So that's all part of the DNA of the corporation. You know, and that DNA, this is, you know, people are beginning to understand that everything about how we design our system can be changed democratically if we want to, if we want to change it. Not only can we, but we've had it that way in previous periods of our history.
Mm-hmm.
So we can look at different periods of our history and say, you know, we had it better that way. Maybe we don't want to go back completely to that old system, but we could pick and choose certain aspects of it and revive them. For example, corporate immortality. Everybody assumes, oh, that's just an automatic feature. That's what corporations mean. People die, corporations live forever. Not unless the charters of incorporations specify that they'll live forever. Until 1903, a majority of states limited corporations in terms of 20 or 30 years, at which point they had to come in and renew their charters. Well, that gave the public a little bit more leverage. Of course, they've generally renewed the charter, but if a corporation was outrageous, like many are, they could pull the plug at that point.
What's happened in all this time to the concept of bribery? I mean, it seems to me that bribery has been pretty much legitimized.
Well, I think it's the other way around. I think that bribery has become unnecessary. Now, look at the Halliburton case. You know, Bill Moyers asked this question about who's making money off Iraq. Well, it turns out that the company with the biggest contracts was Halliburton. Used to be the vice president before becoming vice president was the CEO of Halliburton. Well, so immediately people assumed there was hanky-panky going on, especially because they found out that he was still getting money, you know, residual money from Halliburton. But the fact of the matter is, as far as people can tell, everything about that non-competitive contract that was given to Halliburton was completely legal. Problem was, when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense under the first Bush administration, he began a policy review process to determine how the Defense Department would procure materials for future wars. The company that was hired to design that process was called Kellogg, Brown, and Root. They designed the process. Kellogg, Brown, and Root is a subsidiary of Halliburton. So it's like if you have the system sufficiently wired and you're able to write the rules, you don't need it to bribe anybody. Bribery is beside the point. The bribery is sort of like the way, it's like small-time crime. That's like you steal my boat, you're a pirate, but if you steal a fleet, you know, you're an admiral. You're, you know, you're, you, that, These people think bigger than bribery. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, you
well, by bribery, I guess I'm referring to the idea that you give politicians money and then they support what you want.
Oh yeah. Well, that in
that's
respect,
business as usual.
That's
now.
Business as usual and yeah. perfectly legal.
Yeah.
You know, it was really funny when Watergate revealed that the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland came into the White House with a manila envelope with 1,000 $100 bills in it, and he gave it to Rosemary Wood, President Nixon's secretary, and she took a peek in it and took it downstairs and put it in a safe. Well, that sounds so primitive now, you know, and yet that was 30 years ago. That's how they used to do things.
About 15 minutes left in this 36-minute interview of Ted Nace, author of the book Gangs of America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. This interview was recorded on November 8, 2003. This is American Dream Radio.
There's actually a law that goes back to 1907 called the Tillman Act. It says corporations can't give money to federal candidacies. Still a law of the land. In 1975, the Federal Elections Commission made a ruling. It was really ingenious. Under the Ford administration, they made a ruling that said corporations can have political action committees. Well, they had been allowed to have political action committees before then, but they weren't allowed to do these two things. One was fund the operations of the political action committee out of their treasuries, so basically applying their organizational assets to operating the PAC. But more importantly than that, they could solicit funds, quote-unquote, voluntarily from their own employees for the first time. Prior to 1975, they couldn't do that. So the number of corporate PACs in 1974 was about 80. 10 years later, there were 1,600 corporate political action committees, just because of this little rule change. Mm. And I think as people get more feisty about corporate power, they're going to start asking, where exactly are the specifics? How are things exactly wired up? They want to look in the fuse box, and then they'll find things like this SunPAC decision. And that's very easy to change. That's just the decision of an appointed body of the executive branch of the government. It could be changed tomorrow if George Bush made a few phone calls. And this is the kind of thing that if the country is looking to change that kind of power, this is the place to go. That's why I think these analyses are important. What Tom Hartman's doing, you know, what other people are doing, and analyzing where exactly is corporate power. Where do those buyers go? If we had a chance, which ones would you pull?
Well, it seems like just the way it is. And so there's nothing to be done about
yeah.
it just the way it is.
I mean, the main insight is nobody's really in charge. It's just a very complex piece of machinery. Mm. And over time, it managed to get certain connections made. It's as vulnerable as any other complex machine.
Well, Jim Hightower likes to say, who's got the power in America? And, you know... And the answer, according to him, is that we do, people do.
Andrew Young said, nothing is illegal if 100 businessmen decide to do it. But that's not exactly true. They have to work through institutions. They have to work through mechanisms. So sure, given enough time, given enough businessmen, they'll get what they want wired up. But that doesn't mean that other mobilized groups in society can't go and find those plugs and pull them out. You know, it's always a contested terrain who has the power in a democratic system. As long as we have the formal trappings of democracy, we have the potential to have real democracy. Right now, we don't really have real operating democracy because the desires of a majority of people aren't reflected in policy. That doesn't mean we can't fix that. A democracy is just a system where what most people want is what they're getting. It's clearly not exactly the case.
Let me veer off in another direction. We might come back to right where we are, but I'm just wondering, was there anything difficult for you in becoming an activist? In other words, was it a difficult choice for you, or a difficult process, or was it just...
Well, I think that an activist is somebody who cares about their family. Now, if you care about your family, you also care about other people's kids and their families. So if you're say, someone who's the owner of a small business, you look around the small business and you go, you know what, we all ought to have, these are my friends, these are people I work with every day. If their kid got sick, I'd like them to have health insurance. So because I was in a small business, you know, we only had 30 employees, we were able to give ourselves, you know, good dental insurance and health insurance and all these great things. And we felt like, well, you know, I can sleep well. My conscience is at peace. I may be the boss, but everybody here feels like a colleague and everybody here is protected. Well, the problem was, one day I went, my production manager got sick, and I had to go and straighten out a problem that was happening on an assembly line. This was not an assembly line that we owned. This was one that we contracted with. We were plugged into a larger system of producers and manufacturers. Essentially, we were part of a bigger system. Well, when I went over to that assembly plant, I realized it was essentially a sweatshop. And this is where I had to confront my conscience, because it's not really enough just to make your family safe or your colleagues, make sure they're protected. Really, what you want for your children is what you should want for other people's children, not just because they work with you or for you, but because they live on the same, you know, piece of earth or in the same piece of the universe. So it's that gradually expanding sense of who's us. And I think, you know, for me personally, it was becoming apparent and starting to identify that really I don't like to see any child be hurt or left out or neglected. But if you really feel that way, you have to then look at the systems that create such different circumstances for different children.
Well, and yet, yeah, once you incorporate, especially once you become a larger corporation, then it becomes all about feeding the shareholders.
Right.
If you do nice things for poor people who work for you, you can be sued by the shareholders if they think you could have hired someone for less.
Exactly.
If they think you could have done it and saved a little money. You know, it all becomes about finding the lowest price for the things you buy.
Right.
Which I think is a real problem in America in general, is that it's the Walmart phenomena, which is that when we don't make as much money as we wish we made, we have to find the best deals
right.
whenever we can find them.
Yeah.
And
right.
as we start to find the best deals, it drives the prices of our jobs down, so
exactly.
we have less money to spend on things.
Well, and that's the deep question about capitalism. Are there capitalisms? Are other capitalisms possible? Is a capitalism possible where you legally change the constraint on corporations to broaden it beyond profit maximization as the exclusive concern? So, for example, you could have a capitalism where we program things differently. We change the code of the capitalist system when we say, okay, profit maximization can be the main concern, but at times it will have to move over a little bit on the couch and make room for concerns about the environment, about social justice, you know, however we choose to define it as a society.
Well,
I mean, I keep coming back to this notion, we can have different kinds of capitalism without...
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, Brazil is a lot different society than the Netherlands. Japan is a different society than Russia. You know, in many respects, those different countries have exactly the same resources. They all have intelligent people. But in one set of circumstances, the political structure and the legal structure supports an elite having everything and everybody else having nothing. Whereas in another system, both the culture and the legal system makes it possible for working people to have more leverage to get more of a piece of the pie.
Right. It would be nice to see the momentum shift back to needing not to have everybody have the same. I think that's
well, even
that's
if
not
we went, let's just compare two societies, the USA in 2003, the USA in 1973, 30 years ago, the distribution was twice as even. In other words, the top 1% only had half as much relative to the bottom 93%. Since 1979, the top incomes have tripled. The bottom incomes have only increased about 13%.
And I don't see any slowdown in that.
That's
amazed.
Even before these latest tax breaks.
Yeah.
I heard that in the larger companies, the average was 411 times. By European and Japanese standards, that's far, far beyond.
I mean, whose contribution is worth 400 times somebody else's?
Well, I'm sure there are certain people. But it's become the average among CEOs.
when people try to rein in corporations, it seems that they are accused immediately of being liberals, trying to start a class war. Is this a class struggle, or is this something else?
You know, I think you're talking about sort of the struggle, the way politics is often fought in the realm of how can I say this? Who can spin things in the way that works best for them? You know, if you look at the history of the last 30 years, really, if there's a class struggle, it's being waged from the top 1% against everybody else, and very successfully. But you don't even need to talk about class war. You can define things in all kinds of
ways. Well, it's those people who bring that up.
Right.
It's the top 1% who every time you say, maybe we ought to regulate a corporation or do something, that, you know, they'll say, oh, it's class struggle.
They're basically invoking a taboo.
Yeah.
They're saying, this is taboo, this isn't where we can go. And the interesting thing, I think, about corporate power is it's become acceptable to talk about corporate power, whereas it probably wasn't. It wasn't explicitly, but it was just not something that made sense to people. Like, even 15 years ago, you didn't hear people on the radio talking about corporate power. Now you talk about corporate power on the radio and people know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. A whole new discourse is coming into the culture.
Well, it's been amazing to me that people will understand it, recognize it, and be able to talk about it when it comes to a movie they saw. If you show a corporate fat cat being the bad guy in a movie, nobody has the least bit of trouble understanding that or agreeing, you know, believing it or whatever. But yet you come out into the world and try to say, and maybe this local corporation is doing bad things to us locally, and people don't want to talk about it. Small businesses need to do business with the big corporations. People who aren't in business need to get jobs with the corporations.
The way political arguments are really won is not in the argument itself, but in the framing of the argument. If you can control the framing of the arguments, the rest is trivial. You don't need to win the arguments.
Well, and controlling the media makes that possible for the powers that be.
But it also has to do, I think, I really believe that really good ideas develop a life of their own. And I think that one of the reasons the right was able to rise as it did in this country in the last 20 or 30 years is because the New Deal dropped the ball. The vision of Franklin Roosevelt of social progress for Americans really started falling by the wayside. The people who should have been carrying that vision forward, the Democrats, became the party of the status quo. They were incumbents who were guarding their prerogatives. You saw the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress and the presidency for decades. Did they really come up with meaningful campaign finance reform? Did they make the union movement stronger? Under their watch, the union movement became weaker. The Democrats did not really try to move the country in a progressive direction. And so, after a while, people got tired of them. I think this is the reason in California that people threw out Gray Davis. He wasn't really people would rather have, if there's going to be a Republican as governor, they'd rather have him be a Republican and not a Democrat.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, hasta
la
vista.
One other question, and we'll wrap up. I'm just wondering, the station, our station's the American Dream Radio, and part of what I like to talk about is people's American dream, you know, and what people's ideas are about either what's changed for them about the American dream, or what they think the American dream is now, or what they think the condition, I kind of want to make it as broad as possible, but whether you have any thoughts that you can share about the American dream and your thoughts.
Well, you know, I think the American dream is a country that really works for children. I would like to see a system. I went to Spain and we were with our friends and their 2-year-old got sick. We walked into a clinic and they took care of us. They didn't ask us, what country are you from? What language do you speak? Do you have papers? Are you a legal Spaniard? Or are you an illegal person? Nothing like that. I would like to see any person in America be able to walk into the door of the health institutions of America, the hospitals or the schools, that the children are able to be educated, that they are able to have health care. And if you want that for children, then you want their parents to have decent jobs. And you don't want their parents to be divided up into different groups where some are considered a subclass of people because they may not have been born inside the physical boundaries of this arbitrary country. If you really think and look at the world through the eyes of your own children and think about your own natural instincts to protect those, you know, those vulnerable people, and then you simply extend that view out into any child, then you've got the moral basis to start thinking about society. I do not believe George Bush looks at the world through the eyes of a child. If he did, he would not pick fights with other countries and arbitrarily, use fear to create political power and all the various things that he does. I think corporate leaders who look through the eyes of a child wouldn't be battening their paychecks at the expense of so many of their line workers. They'd want to give their workers a raise. They would see that they didn't need to have any more money. They didn't need to own any more airplanes, you know, et cetera. So I think that there's a moral basis for all of this. Now, the way it actually has to be implemented is through the mechanisms of law and society. You can't just go out there and ask everybody to be a better person, because often the laws are constraining people's natural morality. You know, to be a good person, like the example you gave of why corporations can't necessarily do the right thing because they're legally constrained to seeking maximum profit. So that would be my response.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's always fun to expound and be a pundit.
You've been listening to Ted Nace, author of the book Gangs of America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. I interviewed him on November 8, 2003. His book has been published by Peach Pit Press, but it also can be downloaded for free over the internet as a PDF file from www.gangsofamerica.com. I'm Jerry Krantman, and this program is an original production of American Dream Radio. Find us on the web at americandreamradio.org.